Today on Rock in the Suburbs.
Accordions.
Sometimes multiple accordions, because one isn't enough.
Hello, all, and welcome to Rockin' the Suburbs. This is Beach Boys Week, Day 3. And on behalf of Jim Linehan, I am Patrick Foster. I want to welcome you, the listener, to this episode. And I hope you've been enjoying the series on the Beach Boys so far. Huge thanks, of course, to Nick Scalera and Mike Wagner. Mike hosted the recording, did the recording over there at his place, and really appreciate them putting all this work into it and allowing me to chime in a little bit at the end with things I think are related tangentially. I don't know. But all for a great cause, and that is remembering Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys and the brilliance of the music they left us. I want to say thanks to those who have gotten in touch with me to say how much they're enjoying the series. Just after two episodes, I've heard from a good number of people who have gotten in touch to say how much they're enjoying it. So that's great news. We're happy to hear that. Today, we are going to tackle the album Pet Sounds, the groundbreaking record that came out in 1966. And the guys have plenty to say about this record. So without further ado, we will let them get to it.
And we're starting at the point of how it sort of came into being, which was, there's a story. I mean, I've heard Brian Wilson talk about it. He was stoned, and they got a copy of Rubber Soul, because Rubber Soul came out in December of 1965. And Brian heard it, and it was like a light went off. Why don't you go ahead and read the quote you have there, Nick?
Rubber Soul came out, Brian Wilson said. Rubber Soul blew my mind. When I heard Rubber Soul, I said, that's it. That's all. That's all, folks. I said, I'm going to make an album that's really good. I mean, really challenge me.
And that he did.
Right. Well, it was
mission accomplished.
Even more than challenging himself, I mean, he had the self-confidence that he could do something better than Rubber Soul.
We were just having the conversation. I had noted, I said, I can't think of another artist in that era who said, I'm going to make something as good as the Beatles. He was like, I'm that good. I'm going to do this too. I mean, there were other bands who obviously great, who made great music, but none of them sort of openly wanted to compete. And so basically this is where Pet Sounds starts. And so, Nick, you got some things here to sort of walk us through Pet Sounds, or I think we're going to kind of talk about that briefly, and then I think we're just going to talk about the album. We're just going to have a discussion about it instead of going track by track sort of thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we won't go through all the tracks. You should spend the 35 minutes of your life and do that yourself for those of you that haven't.
Okay.
But we'll go through quickly through some of the context, and then we'll kind of discuss the reaction to it and you know, the recording process and that kind of stuff. So so challenge is accepted. Brian is ready to get rolling on the next project that he thinks will be better than Rubber Soul, or he intends to be better than Rubber Soul.
To compete with,
you know, because Brian gets this idea that, hey, you know, you can make an album that is actually like of a piece. That's not just a couple of singles and some filler, but like one that hangs together completely, which, you know, also incidentally, what he would have had access to is the American version of Rubber Soul, which actually is, because Capitol made some changes, like feels like a very coherent folk album compared to the British version. But anyway, that was Brian's sort of big discovery, is that, wow, you can make a full album as a statement and not just be a singles band.
Right.
That was the takeaway.
Yes.
So that leads him into Pet Sounds. So on December 65, again, right around the time of Rubber Soul, Brian gets Tony Asher to be his collaborator on lyrics. He wanted to go in a different direction than the typical Mike Love lyrics. He wanted to, he was starting to feel like he wanted to express himself more personally in a more introspective way. Tony Asher was a lyricist and a jingle writer, actually, right. For a commercial agency. And they had been, they had met through the sort of connections and the kind of like, you know, the cool set of the, you know, sort of LA music scene.
Of which we, if we were around at that time, we would have been in that cool set.
No doubt.
Yes.
I mean, no doubt.
Exactly.
You know, hanging out at the at Brian's pad. But so he produced the album. It was recorded, produced mainly between January and April 1966. So that's actually, again, you know, for a Beach Boys album, that's a long period of time.
For any album at that era, it's
right,
a long
true.
Period of
and
time.
Rubber Soul was recorded in a month, basically,
yeah.
as a comparison.
Right.
And it was done in multiple Hollywood studios. And, of course, as we talked about before, the Wrecking Crew were doing all the backing tracks. So Brian would be in the studio working with the Wrecking Crew all day long. And the Beach Boys mostly were out on tour, and they would come back and add their vocals. Of course, Brian would also direct the harmonies, and that was a complex process as well. So he began crafting the songs in layered sections with intricate intros, codas, and bridges. And of course, we heard like a very intricate intro for California Girls in the last segment. So he's carrying this on, and as you sort of listen to the songs, you'll hear that there's a lot going on in
there,
each song.
Yeah, I mean, right? If you were to sit and listen to Pet Sounds, and you were sort of do a deep listening, you would hear a lot of things going on. And things that kind of he'll bring a little instrument in at the end, like a God Only Knows, it does the little flourish. There's a high little flourish at the end. Just on and on and on. We could spend a week's worth of episodes just going track by track of each track, and it's just that level of genius.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a fantastic, it's amazingly complex. And again, we talk about, you know, the sort of the beginning of Brian as a musical genius rhetoric. You know, Brian was not classically trained, but musicologists have listened to this album.
Yeah.
And I just want to read this one quick quote, because I don't know what any of this means, but it sounds really complicated. And I think you can tell that in the way the music comes out. The album predominantly features chords that are slashed, diminished, major sevenths, sixths, ninths, augmented or suspended, with augmented and ninth chords appearing less frequently. Is that how you write your songs, Mike?
It's a little simplistic, but no, I'm kidding.
Right. Well,
I mean, the thing to note is that they're sort of, it's obviously it's not a jazz records, but they're sort of on jazz chords. I am no expert. I am not first in that, all that sort of thing. But the way the bass notes moved is a kind of a thing with Brian, and just the chord structures, you know, I've watched people play it, you know, I've watched people play it on guitar or piano, and they'll talk about the, how the song is structured, and just going from different, the way he mixes stuff. I mean, he just hears stuff in his head and he could do it again.
Right.
It comes back to that over and over and over again. He could hear stuff in his head and get it down, which is something that actually he kind of probably lost, you know, we'll come to when he was talking about
on.
Smile.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's, well, Mike Love used to say, our friend Mike Love, that Brian had quote unquote dog ears. And maybe he heard things that other people didn't hear.
I mean, Brian did have they said he had perfect pitch.
Right, right.
Which is not uncommon. I mean, it's rare, but it's not uncommon.
I mean, clearly there's a different sort of intelligence working on a level that most people can never comprehend and never get to.
Right. I mean, and it's the classic thing with genius, right? In certain aspects of his life, when Brian is in the studio, he's in complete control.
Right.
The second he leaves the studio, things become, it's a whole. Yeah.
And I think that's an important point too, because yes, you know, he is said often, like, you know, people say, how do you write a song? I'd be like, it just comes to me. I don't really understand the process. My brain is not really involved. When he's in the studio though, and we've seen these clips and you can hear them on all the various like sessions of Pet Sounds that have been released over the years, 50th anniversary. He is very much in control.
Yeah,
he absolutely is telling the Wrecking Crew exactly what to do with the drums, what to do with the French horn, what to do with the timpani, yada, yada, yada. And it's not, it doesn't feel like some magical inspiration. This hardworking guy that knows exactly what he wants and is telling people how to do the things he wants.
Right. I mean, it takes a lot of work. He has to get all of this stuff. And he has it mostly in his head. I think they did have charts for people.
He used to write things down, but he wasn't necessarily...
Like he wasn't like a guy who could write the charts out.
Right. Like, it wouldn't look like a piece of sheet music.
Exactly. I mean, there's some guys who go into studios who famously prepare everything and they know exactly what they're going to do. Brian was not that way. I mean, the way that the Wrecking Crew told it is that he would go to person to person to person and tell them, okay, you're going to do this and you're going to do this and you're going to do this and you're going to do this. And da, 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 and, you know, and then they would say, okay, now let's do a take.
Right.
And which is completely different than a lot of people's way they would do it. For example, the way Brian did it was completely unique to Brian. Going in and telling everybody exactly what to do is crazy. And then, you know, while they're playing it, going, oh, no, stop. And then he would like, on this bit, you know, and he would have, okay, let's play that bit. All right. That's good. Take 24. And then they would do it again, you know?
Yeah. And it's fascinating. And if you're interested, you can go to YouTube. There's a lot of recordings of Brian at work. It's really fascinating. The other thing to mention is the instrumentation. The instrumentation is wild. This is stuff. Some of these things have never been used in popular music, maybe at least in the way that Brian employed them. We've got, just to name a few, French horns, vibraphones, harpsichords, timpani, bass clarinet, accordions. Sometimes multiple accordions. Right? Because one isn't enough. You got to have a couple going at the same time.
Wall of sound.
Right. And my personal favorite, the 12-string electro mando guitar.
Which is the beginning of Wouldn't It Be Nice.
Yes. It's fascinating. So if you picture the neck of a 12-string guitar attached to a small mandolin-shaped thing, that's what you had here. Bicycle bells, plastic cups, and even barking dogs. So... lots going on in Pet Sounds.
Just so we can show you. I actually, when they had the In Memoriam, and like I said, we planned this for him, but I had to include it on the In Memoriam because it sort of gives you the sense of Brian. I'm going to play it again. This is when they're tracking Wouldn't It Be Nice, and it's just so cool.
Here we go. Wouldn't It Be Nice, take one. Start like that. Hal, here's how I want to do it. Take it, it's like this. Boom! 2, 3, 4, okay? First beat on the last bar of the intro. You'll go boom, 2, 3, 4, bop out, and then start the song, right? Let's come in with those. Here we go, come on. Take 4.
Exacting standards Brian had. He's hearing a lot. Things that no one else is hearing. He's conducting the orchestra. And what you get are some of the most lush and emotionally resonant vocal stacks in pop music history. Just a quick bit on the lyrics. Again, he brings Tony Asher in. Doesn't want to talk about surfing. Doesn't want to talk about cars. He wants to talk about deeply personal, vulnerable, emotionally revealing aspects really here. It explores themes of growing up, loss of innocence, longing, insecurity, alienation, and spiritual yearning. So again, this is a lot different than my 409 is like really cooking down the road and check out those chicks over there. This is a man who is what, 23, I believe at the time, born in 1940. Yes, he's like 23 years old.
He's 2 days apart from Paul McCartney.
Right. So, but, and he's going through a lot. And really, I mean, it's a very personal, again, he didn't write the lyrics, but when he worked with Tony Asher, he would sort of, as I understand it, and as Brian has said, you know, he'd play something on piano and he'd say like, you know, I'm really feeling this about that. And then Tony would work it up into lyrics.
And that's what Tony Asher would say. He would say, I wrote the words, but the feelings and what Brian was trying to get to, I was just sort of like conduit. Maybe a song like California Girls would have been a much better song if something would have come along that would have been more than just California Girls. It could have been
a totally different topic.
It could have taken a song someplace different. I mean, the lyrics, I think about lyrics, and I think they're really important. not so much exactly what you're saying, but kind of how you say it and the rolling of the words. With music, that's sort of a thing, right? It's, you gotta like, and the lyrics in Pet Sounds are really quite good. You know, like, I just wasn't made for these times. It's just brilliant, right? I mean, Caroline, no. It's real heartache. God only knows. It's like, that's so many really great lyrics in the album. They weren't Dylan-esque. You know, they weren't that.
But no, they weren't. You know, it wasn't that sort of edge and sarcasm. It's very earnest.
Yeah, but it's very personal. Yeah. I think, and it's really difficult to write that personal where it's not.
Yeah, it doesn't feel cloying though. Yeah, it doesn't feel precious. It just feels honest.
It feels honest and universal. There's a key aspect to really great albums is there has to be sort of the universality of the feeling. If it becomes too personal, it kind of loses something.
Mm-hmm.
But it matters. I think it matters, and I think it would not be the album it is if it was just California Girls type lyrics.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. And another part of the reason why the next project became problematic is because of the lyrics. And right. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. I think the other, just to finish this thought about the lyrics, is like when you're singing silly stuff, when you're singing Wish They Up California Girls, it's like you can't sing the same way with the same type of emotion as you can I Just Wasn't Made For These Times.
Right.
Right? You just.
Cool. All right. So that's kind of the setup for the record. The only other thing I want to cover, we want to talk about, is the reaction to the album. Before we do that, do we want to like pick a tune and just kind of like talk a little bit about what's going on?
Yeah.
Maybe just start with song number one.
Okay.
Side one.
Well, we did play the beginning of Wouldn't It Be Nice. It is my personal favorite all-time Beach Boys song. It's probably the most. Vocally, it's the most complex because it's got tons of. I mean, I've read that that was the vocals they worked the longest on. I'm out of superlatives. How do you not love that song? I don't know.
Amazing stuff there. I think you can hear sort of all the elements we were talking about, the lush instrumentation, the emotional lyrics, the harmonies.
Accordions.
Two accordions going at once. You know, part of this sort of recording this way was to take multiple instruments, put them together playing the same key or notes and get a sort of a different instrument out of it. And to a certain extent, like, if you listen to the backing tracks of this, which you can do, it's one of the most fun exercises you could actually do to like test your listening ear is and you can find it on the streaming version of the Pet Sounds. There's a version that just has the backing tracks with no vocals. Just listen to it and try to see if you can hear what all the instruments are. It's not easy. I see the list, but I can't pick out everything particularly myself.
The other thing too, there's one, I can't remember which song it's on. It might be Wouldn't It Be Nice when Brian is trying to tell him what to do. He goes, the part where it sings, and he's like, oh, you don't know the lyric. Because the lyrics, keeping in mind that the musicians don't hear
right.
the vocals.
They never heard the vocals.
They never heard the vocal. They recorded all of this without the vocals. And then the vocals came in, were added later, which is, they're playing it. Imagine you play that, and then a couple months later, you hear like, oh, that's what
it
is.
I've heard Carole Kaye and Hal Blaine talking about when they would hear the finished versions and just be blown away.
Yeah, they're recording, and they know that this is like really good. I mean, you can hear that. You can listen to the backing track and go, man, this is really good.
Mm-hmm.
And then and then to have it go off to another level when you hear the vocals is crazy.
Right, right. Just fascinating stuff. So, so what happened? So the album, well, there's two steps. There's the first step is the Beach Boys come back from whatever tour they were on. I don't remember which one. I think it was Japan, because there's actually photos on Pet Sounds of them wearing Japanese garb.
They're in the Far East. Right.
So they're in the Far East. They come back. Brian's been saying, hey, I've got this amazing album. You guys are going to be blown away. You know, there's all this setup. And, you know, they come back. And step number one is for Brian to play the backing tracks for them, introduce the songs, and then put the vocals on top, right? But there's a little skepticism from the band. Of course, Mike Love.
Brian has to battle so many people to get his stuff out.
Right.
I mean, they come back and they hear this and Mike Love's, what are these lyrics? That's not me. Or whatever. I mean, there's one
That's Hang On To Your Ego.
Yeah, Hang On To Your Ego.
Which became I Know There's An Answer.
Yeah, I Know There's An Answer. That's right. Thank you. And as opposed to, say, like the Beatles, when, you know, not too many months later, when John Lennon walks in with Strawberry Fields, he's not met with resistance. It's like everybody's like, this is great. Let's work on this.
Right.
And Strawberry Fields is not exactly I Want to Hold Your Hand, you know? So, I mean, what I think what upsets me about it is people always looked at Brian like, what can I get out of him? It's always seemed to be something about that. What could the record company get out? What can Mike Love get out of him? I mean, I think Carl and Dennis were more supportive because they were his brothers. It had to be just demoralizing to fight that. And I actually, after his passing, there was several in memoriam episodes on different podcasts. And I was listening to an interview he did in 98 when he was released an album. He was making the rounds. I think it was Fresh Air I was listening to. And he talked about in 98, and Terry Gross asked him, like, what took you so long to make another album? You know, from 88 was Love and Mercy, whichever year was.
We had one Brian Wilson. Yeah.
Yeah.
And self-titled.
And then one in 98. Right. And so what? Well, it didn't sell very well. I thought it was a really good record, but it didn't sell very well. So he knew these things. I mean, it was clearly there, as we talked about before. He was competitive. He wanted to compete with the Beatles, and he did. I mean, I would say that Pet Sounds is a better album than Rubber Soul. I mean, you're talking, you know.
Very, very great, too.
Very, very, very,
slightly
rare
very
error.
Greater. Yeah. I mean, Marilyn, his first wife, has said that he never was the same after with the reaction to Pet Sounds. I mean, you know, and Tony Asher, who had written the lyrics, he was like there on the scene when the Beach Boys came back, and like people like, you know, Mike are saying, what the F do these words mean? This isn't our kind of blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was very tense. It was a very tense atmosphere. And, you know, I think Brian had a sort of similar relationship to Mike Love, who was a year or two older and was his cousin, as he did to his dad. Like when Mike right. Love rejected it, that's strong enough. I think Carl should get some credit for being perhaps the one member of the Beach Boys who immediately saw how amazing this record was. Carl actually plays on a couple of tracks, which none of the rest of them did. He added some guitar and some other pieces
and the incredible vocal on God Only
right,
Knows.
Carl
that sings God Only. I mean, and it's amazing.
It's fast. It's the voice of heaven. I mean, it's an unbelievable vocal. And Brian has said, like, he just knew that this was
Carl's thing. Yeah, and he nailed it, right?
Yeah, just absolutely fabulous. So fighting the record company, fighting your band, and fighting the public reaction. So Pet Sounds is released on May 16th. It got to number 10. So to put this in perspective, in the U.S., that was seen as an absolute and utter disaster.
Yeah, but it's not like...
It sold nothing.
Yeah, it probably went to 10 and fell really quick too, right?
Actually it remained on the chart for 10 months. Now, where in the chart it was 10 months later, I don't know. But it was a moderate commercial performance compared to like what they normally have. Of course, as we talked about in the UK, it rose to number 2 in the UK and remained in the top 10 for 6 months there. Totally different experience overseas. The reaction, maybe the British public was just more sophisticated in their taste. I'm not sure what happened.
You mean to the British public because they later chose bands like, I don't know, Oasis?
Slade.
Or something?
Yeah, whatever.
Who knows?
So, but great that he had, you know, and it's worth keeping in mind that, like, Before Pet Sounds came out in the United States, they sent Bruce Johnston, of all people, to the UK.
Right.
And Derek Taylor, former Beatles publicist, was brought in to publicize Brian in the UK. And word got around in London that Bruce Johnston was there with the latest Beach Boys album. And like McCartney and Lennon were like, he got a call. John and Paul are here to listen to this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it was. That was an event. Not just with the buying public, it was an event with the other musicians who we think
right.
of as classic rock gods who are like,
right.
whoa, there's a new Brian. Right. I need to hear this right now. So just a completely different reaction. You know, but Brian was, again, he was competitive and he was very hurt by the fact that it just didn't do well in the U.S. That was the public that, you know.
When you're successful, people want to hear more of what you're doing. But when you have this sort of thing, it's like it becomes very hard to do the next thing.
Right.
And I think that's, I don't know. I mean, something I've talked about with you a lot is this notion of genius and the word great, which I sort of alluded to earlier. It's like, I really wish people would stop using the word great all the time. Because in my view, great is reserved for things like Pet Sounds. Pet Sounds is truly great. What Brian did was truly genius. The great artists don't come around every day. It's like you're not guaranteed in your lifetime to get one. It's just not that way, to my view. There's good music. There's fine music. But these guys, I mean, it's incredible what happened at that time. I mean, we just can't look at it and go like, well, it's still that way today. You know, you just haven't listened enough. I just don't buy that. I just don't buy that argument. Because I can hear Pet Sounds, I can listen to it, and it just, when I put it on, I still get the feeling, that those feelings come back over and over and over again. When I remember, I can put on Wouldn't It Be Nice sometimes, and I still get like the chills on the, you know, that just kind of go through you. And there's just not an album that's been released like Pet Sounds ever again. Not just recently, but like ever. I mean, they tried. I mean, Brian even tried,
right?
And we'll get to Smile in a little bit, but I mean, I really think that this is a singular error, you know, a singular, that's just the word I keep coming back to, effort and achievement like no other.
I agree with you on that 100%. And if you have an album released last year that you think is great, please send it to Mike.
Yeah, I mean,
hit him up on the socials, and you can have that discussion.
Yeah.
But I'd agree that there is never going to be another Pet Sounds. There are unique circumstances that make it that way, but still, just on pure musical quality, I mean, I don't know. No one's going to scale those heights again.
The I mean, it'll happen at some other point in time. I mean,
hopefully
it will. I mean, it will, but it's just not guaranteed to happen when you want it to happen.
Right.
Right. I mean, there will be other, but there's not, it's the same thing. There's not Beethoven's that come out every year.
Right.
Right.
I mean, Wilco doesn't come out every year.
There is that.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Yeah. Any final thoughts on Pet Sounds before we kind of.
I think the main thing I want to say about Pet Sounds is we did spend a lot of time talking about the pre Pet Sounds stuff. I think it's very difficult to imagine nowadays because everybody has access to so much studio time and all this. But you know, you could have that
studio
time
in your bedroom.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if Brian hadn't had all those early hits, if he hadn't been so successful, and if he hadn't produced so much so fast and become the meal ticket for everybody, I don't think he would have gotten the liberty and they leave him alone to do what he was doing in the studio. That growth culminated in Pet Sounds. This is his high water mark, and we'll get into it. But it kind of, things kind of go off the rails after after Pet Sounds.
But we're gonna wrap up this bit of the conversation right now. So is there something else you want to play on Pet Sounds before we move
on? Let's go out with "I Just Wasn't Made for These Times."
Oh, love it. Okay.
So because that's really, I think he points to it a lot too. So
okay.
That's a good one to close out with this.
Cool.
All right. Thanks everybody.
I keep looking for a place to fit in where I can speak my mind.
Right. Thank you very much, Mike and Nick. I always find it very interesting to think about how influential Pet Sounds was. And of course, as we go forward, you know, you'll hear that the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper was definitely influenced by Pet Sounds. A lot of the direct contemporaries around in the music scene in the 1960s were affected by it. It opened up all kinds of new channels for bands to bring in all kinds of different instruments. Suddenly the studio could be an instrument, you know, and I don't know how many people really thought about that before Pet Sounds, and certainly the Beatles thought about it a lot differently after Pet Sounds, and many other groups did too. And I find it interesting that the influence of Pet Sounds continues, and I wanted to point out something that occurred in the mid-90s. Two specific examples of how Pet Sounds continued to be influential 30 years after it was released. And one example is a collective that's been talked a little bit about on this podcast, and that's the Elephant Six Collective. And some members of that collective, which was a loose collaboration of bands, actually had a studio that they named Pet Sounds Recording Studio, and sometimes called Pet Sounds Studio. And it was a recording studio located in Denver, Colorado, and I think later it moved to another location. It was founded by Robert Schneider of the Apples in Stereo and Jim McIntyre of the band Von Hemling. And many Elephant Six albums were recorded in the studio, including the very famous In the Airplane Over the Sea by Neutral Milk Hotel, a record that a lot of people consider a complete masterpiece in the same way that Pet Sounds was, and have the same affinity and same devotion to it. Robert Schneider was one of the leading lights of the Elephant Six movement. He was really into recording and producing, just like Brian. You know, he loved to get into the studio and just sort of use the studio along with the band to engineer these creations. And in addition to the Neutral Milk Hotel album, Olivia Tremor Control recorded there, the Minders recorded there, and of course Robert Schneider's own band, the Apples in Stereo. And there's a song I want to play for you that I think captures this a little bit. It is on an Apples in Stereo record called Tone Soul Evolution. It came out in the year 1997, and the song is called Find Our Way. I love the idea of people who, you know, were born after Pet Sounds came out. Robert Schneider was born in 1971, yet get into music and, a lot like myself, go on this backwards historical journey and find all these things. And it's such resonated with them. And I think a lot of it, too, goes to the fact that there's so much written about and talked about and filmed about and all this about Pet Sounds, that there's so much historical stuff to dig into that it feels very real and feels very meaty. And you can, you know, really bring it into your heart and make it your own. So here, let's hear a little bit of Find Our Way from the Apples in Stereo. Interesting lyrics right there, too. you opened up to the past and let's leave the past behind. So perhaps he is talking about Brian Wilson, Pet Sounds there. Who knows? But thought that was really cool. Recorded at Pet Sounds Studio, the Apples in Stereo from their record Tone Soul Evolution that came out in 1997. Now, the other one I want to bring up really quick was released in 1996, and it's by a band called the High Llamas, described as Anglo-Irish, so definitely from across the pond. The main guy is a guy called Sean O'Hagan, and he had been in a band called Micro Disney, and he did some work with Stereo Lab at one point, but High Llamas was the band that he founded to sort of become his main artistic outlet. And the third record they did was called Hawaii. Definitely is imbued with the spirit of Pet Sounds. And yes, while it is heavily influenced by Pet Sounds, it's also influenced by a lot of other kind of music. Sean O'Hagan himself has sort of cited the composer Stockhausen and also the Wrecking Crew, specifically some of the records they played on and the way they played and all that kind of a thing. And to the point where something very interesting happened with Sean O'Hagan and the Beach Boys. And here's what it is. I'm reading it to you now from the source of all human knowledge. In the mid-1990s, Brian Wilson was struggling to organize a comeback album with the Beach Boys and collaborator Andy Paley. After someone had played Wilson's bandmate Bruce Johnson, the High Llamas album Hawaii, an attempt was made to instead coordinate a collaboration between Sean O'Hagan and Brian Wilson, although it never progressed past the planning stages. Sean O'Hagan actually got as far as to meet with Brian Wilson, and he was there with his wife. Brian was, and Sean O'Hagan was meeting with them, and Melinda said to Brian, "Brian, we want you to make a record, and Sean here is going to oversee it." And Brian says, "Who's Sean?" Melinda said, "He's the guy who made that record you like so much, Hawaii." And then Brian turns and said, "The Hawaii guy? Are you the Hawaii guy? You made that record? Too much. Far out. Music, man. So much music." So it came that close, and apparently Brian really liked the album too, so I find that pretty fascinating. I want to play a song from this record too for you as we go out, and I just like to bring up the ways that a record that is as landmark at Pet Sounds can get into the influence of other people. And certainly you could sit here and name 18,000 bands that have somehow been influenced by Pet Sounds in one way or another. Of course, you could draw the line, but I thought this was a really interesting case too. And yes, an explosion in the mid-90s of people that were probably born after Pet Sounds was released, yet were really into it, came from an era that was romanticized in many ways, but also picked over, and there was a ton of information, and it was also around a time when a lot of the Beach Boys tracks were coming out and, you know, reissues and stuff, and there was a resurgence in interest in this classic period that we're talking about right now. So just a little sidebar there to add on to the Pet Sounds, great Pet Sounds conversation that Mike and Nick have brought us. All right, so we'll go out today with the song Nomads by the High Llamas from their Hawaii album from 1996. I hope you enjoy. And if you're like me, listener, you're looking forward very much to part four of Pet Sounds, which we will bring to you tomorrow. And that's when we'll talk to you guys tomorrow.
way Brian did it was completely unique to Brian.